Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, this is Pablo Zabaleta.
This is Troy Deeney.
This is Kevin Phillips.
This is Jurgen Klopp, and you're listening to The Big Interview with Graham Hunter.
Thank you, Jurgen. I travelled to all these interviews from Barcelona, and our socios, our beloved members, keep us on the road. This independent podcast would not happen without them. Please go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter right now to become a socio, to become one of our members, and get an extra big interview every month, plus loads of bonus content. So go to patreon.com/Graham Hunter, patreon.com/Graham Hunter, and we'll bring you joy. We interviewed Owen Hargreaves for this big interview in a very Goldfinger situation, an august, tree-lined golf course, Bond-esque. Then we moved on to football and ice hockey and basketball. I wanted to know why it was that Stefan Effenberg, remember him? Kicked Owen all the time. What Hitzfeld, Otmar Hitzfeld, said to Owen Hargreaves that stunned him then and sticks with him until today. Frankly, this is above and beyond anything that you'd normally get from a footballer talking about his career, because there's ice hockey and basketball. Listen, it's all in here. Owen Hargreaves, welcome. I often wish that this was a visual medium, not just an audio medium, because we're sitting in a beautiful clubhouse. Straight out the door, I can sniff the freshly cut fairways of a golf club. We can, just from time to time, hear the titler spin hit a good 280 yards down the fairway. And I wish people could see it, because it's a bloody fine place to interview a double Champions League winner. And therefore, I'm going to throw you a curveball, which, given your North American upbringing, you'll understand the meaning of. If you're a golfer and you're a golf fan, how was the weekend for you? Did you follow any of the Ryder Cup? Does golf inspire you in any way whatsoever, apart from being able to hit the ball nicely as you do?
When I was a young kid, we in Canada, obviously it was pretty cold in Calgary, where I grew up, so you know we had minus 30 winters. It was very seasonal, so in the summers, when the weather was good, you tried to play all different sports outside. And we moved neighborhoods as a kid when I was about 8. And because in Canada, all the developments are new. You know, they kind of go further out and they just pop up. And we got a free golf membership with the area. So, you know, my brothers and my dad, we used to play. And then when I went to Europe to play football, because I used to only get a few weeks off, when I used to come home, I have two older brothers and my dad, we had the perfect four ball. So that was a way for us to bond and hang out together and connect and, you know, have a couple of beers and have a bit of competition, but a bit of fun too. So golf, I never took serious, but it was something I loved, and it was a way for me to, you know, spend 4 hours with your dad and your brothers and just have a laugh.
It's a good way to explain it, because golf, for most people, is not a laugh. It drives you absolutely crazy.
Yeah, it drives me even mad too.
Yeah, okay, we share something at least then, but I bet you strike it cleaner than I do. When we did one of our guests on this, it was Stan Petrov, very good Bulgarian midfielder for Aston Villa and Celtic, as you know. And we did that at the Belfry. So I said to him, and I'm going to repeat the trick. I don't know if you talk to the ball or talk to your clubs, but when you're not a particularly good player like me, I reach in and go, no way I'm striking a four iron, that's not my friend. And I go, a six, that's my friend, even if it's the right club or not. Are any of the clubs your friend?
You know what? Because I grew up in Canada, I played a lot of ice hockey in the winter. So I held a golf club like a hockey stick, left-handed. So when I went onto the course at a young age, I held it like a hockey stick. Yeah. But what I realized 4 years later, I was holding it the wrong way around. But because I was a decent athlete, I could smash it. I could figure it out. So I always played cack-handed up until about a month ago. And
that's
when
quite a long time.
So when I played with all the lads, I know that you're with England and Man United and all that. I used to be on the first hole and everybody's thinking, how the hell is he holding the golf club? But then I'd hit it and I'd smash it further than them. And they go, is this a wind-up? So for me, you know, I never knew how to play golf, mm-hmm. which sounds ridiculous because I've played it for so long, but I never knew how to strike a ball properly. I never knew how to hold the club properly. Yeah. It was all self-taught. And then when I stopped playing, I think for whatever reason, my timing and hand-eye coordination, and didn't have any time to dedicate to playing golf because my knee was bad. I couldn't be on a course. So now I've just broke it all back down, started from scratch.
Oh, that's a test.
I just did it a month ago. And you know what? To answer your question, I used to look in the bag and go, no, I'm not hitting that five, yeah. I'm not hitting that. Whereas now, I've had a lesson, I've held the club properly. Now I can hit every club properly. The shape of the ball is proper, the club flight path is proper, and now I actually understand golf, whereas before, I actually played golf, but I didn't understand the technical elements that went into it. So I'm learning to play a new sport, which I've played for over a decade, which
is
ridiculous.
This is quite exciting, because the Pro Tour beckons, I reckon, in which case. If you've been knocking it far and beating fellow pros cack-handed, and now you're going to be good, we're going to follow your career.
Well, no, I mean, you know, for me, when I played football, I never had the dream I could be a professional football player. Not in a million years. I grew up in Canada watching Michael Jordan. I couldn't even watch football on telly because of the time difference, so when I went to Bayern, and I wore 23 because of Michael Jordan, that was my hero as a kid. So I never really had the vision that could be something for me. And when I was able to get in that position and then see, remember when I went on trial at Bayern Munich, I didn't know Bayern Munich, I didn't know anyone there. And after about 30 seconds in, I thought, wow, I'm onto a winner here. You know, you just feel it, you know. I thought I was going to be way out of my depth, you know, 15-year-old kid from Canada on trial at the biggest club in Germany. And I was thrown in, and I thought, well, yeah, I'm better than these. So for me, that was like a moment where I was like, right, now I'm going to go again. Forget being, you know, the most talented player in my area. Now I've gone up a level. So and then you dedicate everything to it. The same with golf, you know. Even though I have no interest in being a great golfer, now that I feel like I'm onto something, I want to suss it out, you know.
You better believe it.
I want to make sure I do better, because that's what helped me become a pro when I probably never should have been. I was lucky. I was quick and I had great endurance, and technically I wasn't bad. But my greatest attribute was I could probably outwork most people, much even better players than me. And I think that's because I had two older brothers who used to kick the life out of me. So when I played against people my age and stuff, I could draw on that experience of competing against my older brother who was 5-6 years older, and my competitiveness is what took me to a career I probably should have never had from where I grew up.
It's not polite at the beginning of an interview to state that I'm going to argue with you about that, but the reason I'm here, apart from us getting to know each other, is that I watched you at a stage where I was despairing about English football and their inability to use their talent well, the evident talent well, and I was living in Spain. What I saw in you, what I watched in you, which we're going to come to, because I have to go back to ice hockey, was the football brain, was the football intelligence on a pitch. Now, whether that was innate or partly taught at Bayern Munich is something we can come back to, but I cannot, no guest ever, well, like when we talked about golf with Stan Petrov, we ended up talking about the fact that he had to do his military service and he could strip down a gun blindfolded and use a gun really well, and that helped him with his handling of clubs, which was a kind of strange anecdote, as was ice hockey. Now, looking at you now, no particular scars. Now, maybe you weren't a Wayne Gretzky or whatever, but how do you play ice hockey? The puck moves so fast, I can sit and watch it, I can't understand what's happening.
But you know what, if you grew up in Canada, you play hockey, it's just a fact. I was never inside, you know, so I used to come home from school at 3:30 or whatever, and if it was nice out, we'd either play street hockey in front of the house, or we'd be shooting hoops, we had a basketball net on the drive, and we just, you know, we put a little, back. I can't believe how old I sound, we had a ghetto blaster out front, we would set it, and we'd just play some tunes and shoot hoops. So in the winter, you couldn't do that, in minus 30, so we used to come home, drop the school bag off, ice rink, and you used to come home when it was dark and have dinner. So for me in the winter, you know, I played ice hockey, and then when I wasn't playing ice hockey, we had two seasons of football. We had the outdoor when it was nice weather, and then we had the indoor when it was minus 30. So we used to have, we'd play in hockey rinks basically, but it was turfed.
So AstroTurf, a form of...
AstroTurf, yeah. But it was a hockey rink basically, essentially, and it was 5v5. So you think that the refs would be in the middle, you'd have two benches like hockey, that would be the players are, and you could just come on and off whenever you felt like it. You know, it was a brilliant way of playing football and different style of football. So for me, I was lucky growing up in Canada. I got to play so many different sports. You know, I played tennis when the weather was good. I played golf. I played ice hockey.
Not lacrosse?
No, I didn't really like lacrosse. I loved hockey, but the problem with hockey was before school, which is ridiculous for your parents. I mean, think about how much work it takes to get your kids ready, you know, get them out the house.
But so we're talking 6 a.m.?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's, yeah, in and around there. And then you got to get the kids to school, and then they got to get to work. So my parents said, look, you got to pick one or the other, because I had football after school. So you got to pick one or the other, because it's killing us, you know. So I played hockey for fun then after, and then football. I mean, before I moved to Bayern Munich, I probably played more basketball than football, seriously.
How were you with the basketball?
I loved basketball, because I was pretty useless at it. But I love the fact that it didn't come naturally to me. So I really had to work at it, and I was a point guard on my high school team. I couldn't really shoot, but because I was so quick, I could make things happen, and defensively I was good. So,
like nicking the ball and mid
dribble? Yeah, I could. Yeah, so I was, you know, I was the creator, the playmaker, and then and defensively, you know. But I was probably too quick for my own good, really, because I was just kind of all over the place. But I loved it, and then in the end, playing so much, I got quite a good vertical, you know. So I could dunk a basketball, even though I was tiny.
So it's not based on height, because what we're used to is like, to get up and dunk, okay, the spring is everything, but if you're 6'7", it helps a little bit, and you're not 6'7".
Yeah.
So what was the trajectory of the jump? Or
no, you just have a spring, you know, but maybe it was because I grew up where our house was. Basically, I was playing uphill all the time, so that probably made my calves probably abnormally strong, which I never really realized at the time, but then when I went and played basketball with all the older guys, you know, which we used to play on with my mates. We used to go to this rec gym, and we used to just play pickup games. And I used to go in and get a rebound. And he said, "How the hell did you get that? You little midget." And I said, "I don't know. I can just jump." You know, so I loved basketball because it was so different from football. Where football, I came from. My dad's a very good football player.
Yeah.
My older brother was a really good football player. They probably both should have been pros. So I only played because I wanted to be like them, whereas basketball wasn't in the family. It was just something I loved watching.
Now, you know, I met Michael Jordan and interviewed him, and I met him in big, imposing, tremendous athlete, well-dressed, got that, not swagger, but that sureness that a great has that just emanates off, and you can smell greatness, and it's in the eyes as he looks at you too. But the thing that struck me was these great big paws of his, cut, bound, leathery, gashes everywhere, little hard pieces of skin, and the amount of tape on his hands. Now, how basketball does that to your hands, even with the ball, I can't imagine. That's my little memory of Jordan. But if you were to use things that people don't play basketball to describe what Jordan meant to you or why he caught your imagination, you know, people around the world listen. So some of them are basketball fans. Some people listen to this might not even know that he's not Joe Jordan's brother. So what about Michael Jordan?
Michael Jordan, for me, was the greatest athlete I ever saw in any sport. And he transcended an era where, you know, basketball was different back then. You know, I think he was one of the first athletes to shave his head. Mm-hmm. You know, he was one of the first back then. All the shorts were really tight. You know, they looked like swimming trunks. So he kind of wore the baggy shorts. He was the first one to have these signature shoes. So, you know, forget the basketball side, which is, you know, he's the greatest basketball player ever. You know, he took that sport and created this whole image, you know, that maybe that even you see now in football with all the big personalities, with Ronaldo's and Messi's. And I think he was, you know, one of that superstar athlete that had all this talent, but also, you know, he became an icon. I mean, that Jordan brand now is almost on par with Nike in terms of value. You know, it's a $1 billion brand. You know, this is a guy that was a young kid, was a basketball player. So he caught everyone's attention in North America. And, you know, I just love watching him. And then to remember thinking as a kid, I never thought I'd be a professional athlete. So I was just trying to get on the cusp of the first team. And they were talking about, you know, about all these silly things that as a kid you wouldn't think of. But like your shirt number and like autograph cards back in the day, you used to have them and stuff. And I was like, am I going to get one of those? Am I going to get one of them? And I had to pick my shirt number. I remember thinking, and they was like, he's 23, is it free? And they're like, yeah. I was like, yes, I can say Michael Jordan on my back, you know. So for me, he was just somebody I looked up to. I didn't have any football idols as such because I couldn't watch it.
You weren't seeing much football.
So it was my dad and my brother. Then when I got into football, when I came over to Europe and I could see Zidane play, and, you know, Varane at Lazio and Dave Beckham at United, you know, and Giggsy and Steve McManaman, they started to become people that I could relate to because they were closer to me and I could see them more. And then I've looked at their games and my games and see how can I implement some of their things into me.
I think I saw, and I'm going to come back and talk to this, particularly for England, particularly in the World Cup, where I looked at you and I thought, that's a completely different breed of player. I remember writing at the time, wrote quite a lot about you, thinking, this is the missing piece that will make all the talent blend. What struck me was I'd rarely seen an English player so intelligent about space and closing and what to do with the ball once he received it or showing for the ball, but particularly asphyxiating dangerous players, anticipating what was going to happen, and then saying, right now, guys, I'm going to give it to you, Gerard Lampard, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Now, listening to your description of basketball and the mindset it needs and the anticipation, because it's not pure athletic speed that gets you into those situations.
Yeah.
You have to read what the other team is going to do. And the ball moves so quickly, as it does with ice hockey. Mentally, that was that was an SAS training in anticipation of opposing players that you had with the speed of those two games.
Yeah, but when I came into Bayern Munich, it was just, I don't think a youth team player had come through for 4 or 5 years. So young players didn't come through, and the team was so established. And young players and older players, it was the opposite of England, where they really helped the young kids. You know, there was a big divide between the old and the young. And for me, you know, once I kind of came in, I couldn't afford to make mistakes, because if you make mistakes, you stick out.
Yeah.
You know, so you learn quickly, you know, I got to make good decisions. I got to be in the right places at the right time. I can't stick out negatively. And I remember my manager at the time, Otmar Hitzfeld, I just started training, and I was training pretty well. And some of the older guys were getting pissed off a little bit with me. And he pulled me aside once after a session. He said, look, Owen, I can't tell you any more than this because I'm on the old guy's side. But he said, this way it works is if they're pissed off with you, if they don't like you. Because if they don't like you, it means you're a threat to them. And he said, the only way this way, you got to hunt them every day on the football pitch. Off the pitch, you got to be respectful of your elders, and you got to open doors and carry balls and carry goals. But on the pitch, they got to take notice. And he said, that they're mad at you. He said, trust me, you're on the right path. Keep doing what you're doing. And it was the best piece of coaching advice I was ever given, you know, because it made me realize, as much as you have to be respectful, when I get on the football pitch, you know, you got to go after everyone. Doesn't matter who they are, as big as they are. And you got to trust your instincts. And once I started to figure that out and, you know, and learn when and where I could make mistakes, then it kind of all starts to come together.
It's a tremendous sense of liberation when a leader, somebody upon whom your future rests, says to you, son, you're bang on there. That gives you a liberation because you've intuited what you've had to work out. How do I treat, I don't know, Kafur or Effenberg or Schweini was after you. The big dogs, Salihamidzic. I don't know who you gave the biggest chasing to. Linke, maybe, on the training ground.
Effenberg, he kicked me every day for a year. Every day he kicked me for a year. And I remember one day, it was coming towards the end of the season, and we were at a friendly in Africa somewhere. I forgot where, and was about to get on the plane just before, and he was in front of me. I said, no, Effie, you go first. And he said, no, he said, oh, and you go first. He said, you're going to be my successor. You earn the right. You know, just off the cuff. And I thought, what's going on here? I said, this is a weird moment. But, you know, it was almost like the young kids don't really get that now. But for me, you have to earn their respect and earn their trust. You know, nobody else was there. And I just think every time he used to kick me, he used to pick me back up. And I didn't say anything, you know. But I would try and give as good as I could get, but I would never make it personal. But the point is, sport at that level is about competition. Whether it was my older brother I was competing with or then Effenberg, you know, you have to learn to cope with that environment. I think a lot of young kids, that's difficult, you know, to come into that environment. You come from an academy where everything's catered for you. You're the best player. You're Man City or you're Liverpool, you're Man United. You blow away every team 7-8-0. All of a sudden you come into men's football, and it's all about competition. You can't afford to make mistakes. You know, you have to be competitive. And I think some of the kids coming through now, they can all play, but can you compete? That's one of the greatest attributes I think any athlete can have is can you compete? Because You know, I think football players are, you only really know them when it's bad. You know, when it's bad, then you see people's true colours. And football's easy when you're winning and, you know, the weather's good and stuff.
Am I hearing an explanation for a question I wanted to ask you about Sunday the 5th of July 1998? And for anybody who thinks Bjorn Andersson was part of ABBA, he wasn't, he was your coach.
Yeah, he's the guy that brought me to Bayern.
Yeah, Borussia Dortmund 2, Bayern Munich 1 on penalties. I'm going to read it quickly because nobody's ever heard of any of them. Mario Bartolovic, Sebastian Bakker, Stefan Struns, Christian Lessmann, Niels Erik Johansson, Owen Hargreaves, Michael Fischer, Thomas Rice, Patrick Mösel, Stefan Höfman, Berkant Göktan, and the Dortmund team, which should be full of people where we go, oh yeah, I know him, isn't. And that cup final ends with 8 consecutive penalty misses and Dortmund wins. And the point that struck me when I was looking at your background was nobody from those 29 players used, I don't know quite why there were 4 substitutes used by Dortmund, none of them really came through to senior successful level except you.
Berkan Göktan was probably the best youth player I've ever seen in my life. He was like the old Brazilian Ronaldo. He played in the first team at 17. But then he went to the first team, was nutmegging everyone. The old guys started getting mad. They started smashing around. He went on loan and it never worked out. But that was probably one of the most talented players I've ever seen in my life. So it just shows you can get to that point and still fail, you know, if the variables aren't right. You know, Patrick Müller, he was a number 10 for Germany. He was a super player. Sebastian Bakker, everybody said he was going to be the Mateus in 10 years. Stefan Hoffmann, I'm the godfather to his daughter. He became player of the year in Austria a few years. So all the guys are in the same position. You're in a position to strike, you know, but you got to take the chance. And I remember, as much as, you know, I was in around the first year, I was training, I remember we played Real Madrid in the semi-final. And I had played quite a few games, but not anything like that. And I remember, I think Effenberg was suspended. And they weren't sure who to play. And they had Sforza and they had Fink and they had all these, you know, kind of veteran guys. And Omar Hitz would pick me to play. And I remember thinking before the game, Luis Figo at the time, I think he was the most expensive player in the world. And I loved Luis Figo. And Ivan Helguera was one of my heroes. You know, I loved him as well. So I remember thinking before the game, in the dressing room, thinking, I'm in trouble here. Luis Figo. You know what I mean? This is a long way from...
Your third midfielder that you were up against was Guti.
Guti, yeah. I love
so if the other two weren't on it, there was only Guti to worry about.
From, you know, young kid from Calgary. And then I remember Figo, he tried to dribble around me early doors in the game. And I took it off him and skipped by him. And then Roberto Carlos, and I ran by him. And I remember just thinking, and I crossed it, or something happened. And I ran back. And I remember, it was like a light went off in my head. And I remember just thinking, I don't gotta be scared of these guys. I know they're much better than me, but I can outwork them or I can influence them. Mm. And it was one of the most powerful moments I ever had in my life because it made me realize, as good as those guys are, they only got 2 feet, you know? And there's one ball between us. Who wants it more, you know? And I remember after, I came in the dressing room after the game, we won. It was the second leg and we got to a Champions League final where we played Valencia. And I was still on like a reserve team contract. I mean, I was getting a drink in Rummenigge. Was next to me, and he came in and he said, "Oh, tomorrow we'll do a new contract. You outplayed your old one." And you know, and it wasn't about any of those things, you know, money or anything. But it came once you performed, and I love that about Bayern Munich because they were the first one to say, "Look, let's do a new one." But I remember that moment kind of was my first moment where I thought, I could make it here.
But I like very much that the same light that had gone on in your head on the pitch had happened to Karl Heinz in the stand, looking at him going, that guy's coming off the junior contract, this guy's getting tied to us right now.
Well, and I didn't have an agent really at the time.
Yeah.
So I wasn't in a position, like now all these young kids, you know, that they got all these big agents and you know, agents all this leverage 12. And, you yeah. know, it's yeah. it, the game has changed dramatically, really.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm not necessarily the best storyteller in the world, but I want to build back to the 9th of May 2001 when the light goes on in your head. The move from Calgary to Munich is, you've documented it well, is tough. And in this series, we've talked a lot about loneliness. We've talked about separation from parents, what brings you through it. It's really interesting. You've speculated in the past that had there been electronic media, the bad days when you come home, and as well as you've done for the week, it's been a shit day.
Yeah.
You feel somebody's told you off, or you've had to clean the shower 6 times, or somebody's kicked you. On that day, you say to your parents, "Ah, this is I'm about." So that didn't happen. But you hadn't quite broken through to the senior level in 1999.
Yeah.
It's the 20th anniversary next year of United's treble.
Yeah.
You're at the club, you're in the, I don't know if you're in a flat by then or you're still in the youth complex, but the club you are attached to is playing against a club which is, I don't know, 15 minutes journey from the club that your dad adores, evidently passionately, Bolton Wanderers. It's Lancashire, it's northwest of England. It's also England, it's Beckham. So did you pretend that you were supporting Bayern Munich, or were you already attached?
No, we were...
How the hell did you handle that game?
We were there with the under-18s. We were in the stand, and I remember the game. Bayern were better, really.
They ran the game for 90 minutes.
But they just, united that bit of magic at the end. And I remember we all sat, we were kind of in the back of the goal, I think the goals were on the other end, and we were going to a youth tournament in Rotterdam after it was quite a big youth tournament in Feyenoord that they used to host. So the game finished, and we had all screamed our lungs out, and we all just sat in shock. And a lot of us had lost our voice because we were really just like cheering things on. So for me, if I work for you, you got my heart and soul, right? So I wouldn't say I had my eyes on my, even though, I always thought it was a special club. I was at Bayern Munich. I was in the academy. I wasn't even a first team player.
That was it.
I was cheering for Bayern Munich, And then we were all stunned. So for me, I never really later down the line that 2 years later I could be in a Champions League final in that same spot that those guys were. That's
what I was going to ask you, because I suspected, having watched you and listened to you, that you were Rot Weiss of the Bavarian kind, not the Old Trafford kind. But what was the atmosphere in the club? Because, I was there that night. To me, it was the Aberdeen manager going up and lifting the trophy. There were tears in my eyes, even though it was United. But the shock value was there, that watching United and how they reacted to it, and how Fergie quickly saw players he thought maybe just got a little bit too big for them. But he said so. He said so the following season when Monaco knocked them out. What was the atmosphere like around Bayern Munich at that stage? Was it just never talked about, we need to put that right quickly and win the European Cup? When was the first time somebody mentioned it to you again in July when you're back in training? Or was it never even approached?
Omar Hissel was a great manager because he wasn't emotional. He was very, very factual. And I don't think we spoke about it dramatically in terms of, it was just, football is a beautiful game, but it can be an awful game at times as well, because the highs and lows of the emotions are difficult to manage. So I think if you're in it, you understand that, the highs are great and the lows are low, and that would be that's how big a low as you'll ever get. But the Germans were so mentally tough, and the expectations at the football club were always of the highest level. We used to come in after games, we'd win. Karl-Heinz Rummenigge would be there, and fans back about Uli Hoeneß, and they said, that wasn't good enough. 2-0, you guys, you got to put them away earlier or something. So it was always, you got to win the league, and then you got to try and do really well in the Champions League. And so for us, next year, same expectations, and we had an experienced group of players, and we were fortunate enough to be able to get back there pretty quickly.
Yeah, not so much fortune. I was also, as a punter, I was in Milan that night where your performance against Figo and Real Madrid had helped the 2-1 win in the qualification for the Milan final. And it's only 2 years later. Penalties play a big part in your life, don't they?
Strangely, yeah. I mean, I've won two Champions Leagues on penalties, and I've lost virtually every major tournament with England on penalties.
Albeit that you scored against Portugal.
But yeah, I mean, I've
penalty shootout in the Dortmund Bayern Munich youth final that I mentioned before.
Yeah, a lot of those moments were decided by penalties. Strangely, in club level, I've had fortune. I've had success. And international level, I've had none. So it's.
What's your relationship with the elf meter?
It's something so different from actually football, because football, the ball's always moving. It's more like golf, really, where the ball's still and you've got a lot of time to think. And if you're thinking too much, it's going to go pear-shaped. So, you know, it's not a hard physical task if you think about it. You know, from 11 meters to hit a stationary ball, it's not that hard. But you got to take into account all the pressure in the moment and the situation. And all these sports psychologists can talk about these things, but you can't recreate those variables without the situation itself. So I remember with England, you know, we had some of the best penalty takers you could ever dream of, literally. I mean, if you could draw them up, you'd take these guys. And we didn't win, you know, we just couldn't. I don't know why. But I remember being in and amongst those group of players when we got knocked out in 04 and 06, especially 06. And it's quite a select, even the guys that are in the squad, they're not in amongst the 8 or 10 that are taking them, right? Then so the boss picks them, and some people want one and some people don't. And after the first one, you can feel it kind of developing, you know, good or bad. And I remember with England, I just remember it being eerily quiet, almost too quiet, which I understand because everyone's thinking, right? Everyone's thinking, God, you know, I want to score, you know. But the problem is, and when I was in that, and we end up not winning with England, for whatever reason, I remember when I got in that situation with Man United after my experiences with England the couple of years before in the Champions League final against Chelsea. I remember Cristiano missed. I think he missed second, and I was next.
Well, it goes for the point where, actually, had you not scored, Ashley Cole was in a position to win the match rather than John Terry. So I think that you maybe went third.
I went third, yeah. I think Giggsy went first. Cristiano second. I remember when he missed, I thought, oh, he's killed me there. And I remember, you know, when you get up there, you have so much time to think, really. And I remember going up, and Balak was there on the Chelsea team, John Terry, Ashley Cole, Frank Lampard. And we used to practice pens with England all the time. And I used to always go top left without fail. Everybody knew
that. Just so everybody can picture it.
So the goal's in front of me, my top left, yeah.
Your top left.
Yeah, like a free kick, basically. I whip it top left. And everybody knew that, right? So I guess as I've gone up, the Chelsea boys on the middle of the pitch are all pointing top left, right? And we had practiced it, you know, for a couple of weeks. And I didn't miss one. And even the night before in the Moscow Stadium, Sir Alex told me to stop because I was just whipping them top in. And as I've stepped up, I thought, you know, just checking, I walking up. And it's quite a slow walk, you know, because it's weird. You're thinking, should I jog up? No, I don't really want to jog up, but it looks
overly
keen.
You're already in the mind. Yeah. You're not telling me this. You're listening to your mind on the night.
It's unbelievable how much you can process in a 10-second walk. And you know everybody's watching you. And so as I'm walking up, I'm thinking, I'm sure those guys are telling check I'm going top in. So I'm thinking, maybe I'll go bottom corner, other side, you know? Right. Just most ridiculous logic, right? So as I've...
It actually makes sense.
It remotely makes sense. But so as I've gone up, I thought, I've looked at it, checks in the goal, he's like 6'4", isn't he? And it looks...
The goal feels small.
So the goal looks different when there's a guy 6'4" in there and 30,000 people behind the goal. So as I've gone up, I thought, what am I doing changing my mind here?
Good for you.
What am I doing changing my mind here? He's in goal because he's pretty good at his job. If he saves it, hats off to him. But he's not, you know, I'm going to do my best. If his best beats mine... Hats off. And I went out and whipped it top bin. And it was a great pen. And it was a great lesson for me to, you know, rather, you know, trust your instinct. You can think too much. And I think the people that succeed in these moments, whether it's golf or football, whatever, are the ones, because everyone's thinking, but can process the information without getting stressed or without changing their mind. Yeah. And I had lots of different things I was thinking about. But actually, when I went up, I stuck with my initial thought, even though I was processing different variables.
You were bringing in, maybe they've tipped him off, and maybe that will help him.
Yeah.
But you went, like, I know what I do well. I'm going to do what I do well.
And he guessed the right way.
But so they had told him, and he'd gone, I'm going to go with the information.
But he got, you know, he was never going to save it. You know,
it's a thrilling moment, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's not, like I said, it's not a hard physical exercise. It's a really easy physical exercise. For somebody that's hit, you know, probably a million balls, it's not hard. But, you know, to do it, like you the analogy of the Ryder Cup and stuff, those guys hit golf balls all their life. But, you know, the Europeans did it better than the Americans when the push came to shove. So coping in that environment is, I think, a rewarding thing for any athlete, because you've trained all your life for those moments, really. If I ask any of the guys now I work in TV with, I said, how many games of your career do you remember? You know, seriously, you played 500, 800. And there's probably 10 that stick out for you, you know, really stick out that you remember and people identify you with. And some of those moments are the ones that a lot of people, if they see you on the street, they remember you. And moments that you remember, because you can't remember every game. You know, you can't remember every moment.
It's impossible. And fans, we obsess, we get geeky. So that's why you get asked so much about things like, fellas, I don't remember, but you'll remember this. And the word in Spanish is atrevido, and it means cheeky. So I mean to be cheeky in the nicest possible sense, but given what we've just talked about, how in Milan did about, let me just count them, 50 players take a penalty, and you didn't?
Well, that was because of the hierarchy of the older and the young, you know. So I remember I said to Carson Yonker, it was just he and I left. Carson was a big
and
boy.
If Carson hadn't kept hitting the woodwork in the Camp Nou 2 years previously, Bayern Munich would have wrapped up that 4-0 win.
Exactly. So I was a young kid. It was my first season. So it was more, I didn't think it was my place to take a, even though I always took penalties.
Are you telling me you wanted one?
I would have taken one, 100%. So I said, Carson, it's you and me left. And he said, I'm not fucking taking one. And then.
At least he was honest.
Yeah. And then Pellegrini, he missed. So I was next up, I think.
So you were next up. Because you stand watching some of the penalties with your arm around Thomas Linke, who scores effectively what proves to be the winning penalty. So maybe you just transferred by osmosis a little bit of that Hargreaves elf meter technique in standing close to Thomas.
Well, you know what? Going back to that experience with England, you know, where it was really quiet, you know, I really think that's where a team can help. And when we were with United and Cristiano missed the second one, I was third. And then I came back to the huddle and, you know, we're in a decent position. You can see a lot of people within themselves thinking. And in that moment, after what happened with England, I realized, you know, I got to get these guys to stop thinking, you know. So whether it was, you know, Rio or Nani or Anderson, any of them, I said, you're going to score, man. You're going to score. I know you can. You're going to smash your top in. Don't change your mind. Pick your spot, you know. And then people, you can see them rather than thinking on their own.
Yeah.
You know, you engage them and you can make eye contact and you give them a bit of confidence. Because I think in those moments, maybe some people want to be on their own to think, but actually, it's important to be engaged so you can't overthink. And I remember I spoke to Rio about it years later. This, like, feeling started to develop, you know, where everybody was, like, together, you know. And strangely, John Terry, I don't know, he was the only player that slipped that night, you know. I know the rain was coming down and everything, but it was like, it just went in our favor. And football is sometimes like that, you know. It goes against you, and then for whatever reason, in that moment, he slipped. And we win.
This one's for your dad, who I take it is still with us and well in Calgary. Not long after the end of his Bolton Wanderers reign, when he helped steer the Trotters into Europe for the first ever time, I interviewed Fernando Hierro. He's quite an imposing and impressive kind of dude. And I wondered if a regal guy from Real Madrid had genuinely enjoyed the Reebok and Sam Allardyce and training in somewhere where you had to come back muddy in a minibus to, you know, get washed at the stadium. Yeah. I loved it. He said a really funny thing. He's a tough guy, Hierro. Right?
Yeah.
He said he was watching your final, the Moscow game, and he said when Terry slipped and the ball went wide, he said, I wanted to run on the pitch and hug him. Like, what? That's such a weird kind of sentimental for a tough guy to think like that. And I wonder when you watched it then, when you watched it back, you know, any sympathies for John?
Oh, definitely. I mean, yeah. I mean, we had an England game 3 days later at Wembley against the US. I mean, imagine, we just beaten Chelsea and then we played 3 days later in a friendly against the US and we had all sat there on, you know, one end of the table, you know, one of the best moments of our careers, and the Chelsea boys had the opposite. So, you know, Frank and Ashley Cole and John Terry. So, yeah, and I had been with JT from even in the England under 21 teams, you know, coming through. So, of course, there's a human side where you really feel bad because, you know, it can happen to any of us. Mm. And in the end, it makes you realize how small and fine the margins are in sport and football at the highest level.
We have sponsors who are Bet365, and they've sent us in a question, which is for you. And it's one that bridges England, Bayern Munich, Calgary, if you want. Was it the Foothills?
Foothills, yeah.
Calgary, Foothills, Manchester United. So the guys at Bet365 want to know, Owen, who is the best footballer in your personal assessment that you ever played with or against?
I mean, it's difficult because it's like, how do you compare Paul Scholes and Cristiano Ronaldo?
You know, personal preference.
You know, one is 6'2" and quick and can go both ways and you know, and headers and all that. And Scholesy is just this genius of a brain that is two steps ahead of everyone else, that really physically, with the attributes he had, probably shouldn't have been able to dominate football games like he did. Cristiano was abnormal because, you know, physically he had so many dominant traits where he was big and strong and quick, could both ways, free kicks, corners, everything. Scholesy was just a player's player, you know. He was just, sometimes I used to laugh, it was so easy for him, you know, because he was just so gifted. But I remember playing against Zidane. I always loved Zidane, and then playing against him at Real Madrid with Bayern and stuff. You know, I love playing against them. And you'd never tell your heroes that they're your heroes, you know. So you, in the end, you've got to compete against them. But what struck me about it, he was so quiet when you went around him. You could just hear him breathe. That was it. You know, he didn't really talk much, but he was just such a genius. So there's different levels of genius. Scholesy and Zidane were kind of mentally, you know, ahead. And Cristiano, you see, those guys are like the old Ronaldo. You know, when you're that quick and that powerful and that explosive, it's virtually impossible to stop. Whereas those guys were sharp with their brain.
People, I've been lucky enough just to be near Zidane, maybe in press zones or tunnels or whatever. People forget, and I'm certain you weren't in any way intimidated, but people forget because of his elegance and what he did with the ball. And our amateur eye follows the ball, the trajectory of a shot or a pass. But he was a serious physical unit.
He was huge, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember, it was the only guy who ever did it to me. Because I was quite quick, and obviously I was a lot shorter than him. I'm guessing Zidane's probably 6'1", 6'2", maybe. Then I was surprised how tall he was. And I remember it would make it look like the ball was free. So he'd just leave it, say there's a couple of yards distance from us. Like it was free. And obviously I'm a bit thick. I think, oh, I'm going to get it off Zidane. And I would dive in to take it. And he would just stick up this massive leg, kind of his foot just off the air and his quad tense. And as you went into it, you just straight into his quad. You think, and it was like a brick wall. Like, what happened there? And he would just spin the other way. And I remember thinking, what happened here? Well, he's literally lured me in like a bull rider or whatever. And then he just span the other way. I remember actually clapping in my mind for Zidane and going,
I salute
lad.
You for that.
Yeah, I like
that's
that.
A gentleman in football to go like, I didn't like what happened to me, but chapeau.
You just humbled me. I like that.
Oh, that's absolutely beautiful.
Thank you for joining us for season 2018-19. We've got huge creative plans for the months ahead, but we do need your help to make them happen. Please go right now to patreon.com/GrahamHunter and become a socio, become a paying member, and get an extra big interview every month plus loads of bonus content. Last season, socios listened to 9 exclusive big interviews, including Rafa van der Vaart, Troy Deeney, Roberto Di Matteo, and loads of me talking about football. The Premier League, the Champions League, Spanish football. I'm sure they enjoyed it and you will too. Support us, join us. Thank you.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.